Welcome to the 502nd of the COVID calls. This is a daily discussion of the COVID-19 pandemic with a diverse collection of disaster experts. My name is Scott Gabriel Knowles. I'm a historian of disasters at the Korea Advanced Institute of Science and Technology. I'm coming to you live from Daejeon, South Korea. Today in this episode, I welcome Mark Williams and Jan Zalashevich to discuss their new book, The Cosmic Oasis, The Remarkable Story of the Earth's Biosphere. Just a reminder, you can catch COVID calls live on Twitter and on the COVID calls YouTube channel. You can hear COVID calls anytime recorded as podcasts on Spotify, iTunes, Podbean, or anywhere you get podcasts. You can also keep up with COVID calls information via Twitter using the handle @USofDisaster or @COVIDCalls. Please help spread the word and send suggestions for future guests and future topics. As always, please feel free to suggest yourself as a future guest. Today marks the first COVID calls episode since we hit 501 episodes in March of this year. Since that time, the team has been very hard at work on the archives, with audio, video, and transcripts, as well as artwork all collected in one place. Please check it out at covid-calls.com. And as I mentioned a moment ago, we are scheduling COVID calls episodes out through the end of this year. So I do welcome your suggestions for guests that you enjoyed that you'd like to hear from again, topics that you think we should cover, themes that are not getting enough attention in the mainstream media that you'd like to hear us talk about here on COVID calls. So please do send me those suggestions. As of September 14th, 2022, 6,518,247 people have lost their lives worldwide, according to the Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. 1,051,303 deaths are recorded in the United States, 685,002 deaths recorded in Brazil. In the UK, 206,752 deaths attributed to COVID-19. And in South Korea, where I am, 27,593 deaths have been attributed to the virus. Of course, these numbers are probably an undercount, but again, reported by Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. I've been reading an obituary or a story of advocacy for those impacted by the pandemic. I'd like to continue that now. Headline, Mark Lewitton, COVID patient, dies at 76 after 850 days on a ventilator. This was published September 9th, 2022 in the New York Times by Clay Risen. As the COVID-19 pandemic swept across the country in March of 2020, the family of Mark Lewitton, their 74-year-old patriarch, urged him to stay indoors. He had survived lung cancer and a stroke that left him unable to speak, and doctors were already warning that older people with his sort of medical history were especially vulnerable to the virus. He complied more or less, but he soon felt cooped up, and one day he ventured into a crowded Starbucks near his home in Cliffside Park, New Jersey. By March 25th, he was feeling lethargic. A pulse oximeter showed his blood oxygen level at just 85%. His son Albert, a TV producer, took him to the emergency room at Weill Cornell Medicine in Manhattan. The hospital was inundated with patients and doctors in hazmat suits, and it took hours for someone to see him. He tested positive for COVID-19 that night. 6 days later, with his oxygen level falling further, doctors decided to intubate him and induce a coma. They told the Lewitton family that Mark, a retired Manhattan shopkeeper, would likely die within a few days. In the early months of the pandemic especially, the survival rate for intubated COVID patients was about 50%, and that included people who were younger and healthier than Mr. Lewitton. They stepped outside with the iPad to ask us if we wanted to just give him morphine and let him pass away naturally, Albert Lewitton said in an email. On a group FaceTime, we urged my father to fight. We didn't say goodbye. We said, keep fighting, Dad. You're going to be fine. Mr. Lewitton stabilized and recovered from COVID, but he remained too weakened to come off the ventilator. After 6 months, he was brought out of his coma and eventually moved to another hospital closer to his New Jersey home. After 850 days on the ventilator, Mr. Lewatin died of a heart attack on July 23rd of this year at Palisades Medical Center in North Bergen, New Jersey. He was 76. His son, Albert, confirmed his death. While there are no comprehensive statistics for how long COVID patients have survived on ventilation, medical experts say Mr. Lewatin may hold the record. The literature around the pandemic notes a few patients who have lived more than 3 months. A patient in Alabama made headlines in 2021 when he came off a respirator at 187 days. None of those come close to Mr. Lewatin's streak, a combination, doctors say, of his physical and mental strength and the swiftness with which the medical establishment developed protocols for long-term COVID care. He had a long and difficult course, Dr. Abraham Sanders, one of his physicians at Weill Cornell, wrote in an email. He was a strong man and was the beneficiary of sophisticated medical care. Murad Albert Lewatin was born on March 12, 1946, to a Jewish family in Cairo. He anglicized his first name to Marco as a child and later dropped the O. His father, Albert Lewatin, was a medical engineer, and his mother, Sarah Amiga Lewatin, was a homemaker. He grew up speaking Arabic and later learned English, French, and Spanish. Egypt had a thriving Jewish community of 75,000 people, but they faced worsening conditions after the Arab Nationalist Revolution in 1952 and the Suez Crisis in 1956, which pitted the country against Israel, France, and Britain. The government took over the elder Mr. Lewatin's business, and after being briefly detained, he and his family were expelled in 1958. They settled in Baltimore, where Albert Lewatin was hired by Johns Hopkins University to work on organ transplant technology. As a young man, Mark lived in New York City and Los Angeles, where he briefly attended college, then Paris, where he met Ondine Green, the sister of a childhood friend from Cairo. They married in 1968. The Lewatins settled in the New York City area, first in Brooklyn and later in Tenafly, New Jersey. He opened a business on the Upper West Side that operated as a sort of everything store for the neighborhood: pawn shop, film processing, electronics repair, jewelry. It became a local fixture. John Lennon, who lived nearby, came in occasionally, and Mr. Lewatin hung a picture of himself with John Lennon on a wall at the store. He sold the business in 1981, after which he bought and sold real estate and later traded in art online. Mr. Lewatin was an ardent supporter of Israel and Jewish causes. He raised money for Ethiopian Jews fleeing their country as refugees and won praise from the Nazi hunters Simon Wiesenthal and Charles Kramer for helping to persuade the U.S. government to deport Archbishop Valerian Trifa, a Romanian cleric and fascist collaborator who had moved to the United States after World War II. In 1995, Mr. Lewatin sued the Egyptian government to win the release of several Torah scrolls, prayer books, and other religious items seized from the country's Jewish community in the late 1950s. Along with his son, Albert, he is survived by his wife, another son, Lawrence, a financial journalist, his daughter, Sarah, a record producer and DJ, his sisters, Fortuny Ye and Rachel Agazi, his brothers, Solomon, Michael, and Nassim, and two grandchildren. The life story of Mark Lewatin. Okay, I'd like to turn to the conversation for today, and let me introduce my guests. Mark Williams is a professor of paleobiology at the University of Leicester. He grew up in the small town of Biddulph on the northern extremity of the Staffordshire coalfields in England, and was lucky enough to be able to pick out the fossils of goniatites, ancient relatives of squid, from rocks cropping out just up the road from where he lived. That experience stayed with him through his life, and he has spent his career trying to explore the evolution of the biosphere over hundreds of millions of years, including in the Anthropocene. He has written several popular science books with his friend Jan Zaleshevich and has been a working member of the Anthropocene Working Group since its inception. My second guest is Jan Zaleshevich. She is emeritus professor of paleobiology at the University of Leicester, growing up around the coal country of Lancashire. He's a generalist with field geology, paleontology, and stratigraphy, somewhere in the mix, and longstanding enthusiasms for mud and mud rock, long-dead plankton, and the enigmas of ancient climates. Interest in human-made geology started by chance, then became inescapable. He's written books such as The Earth After Us, The Planet in a Pebble and Geology, A Very Short Introduction, also with Mark Williams, The Goldilocks Planet, Ocean Worlds, and Skeletons. With Julia Adney Thomas and Mark Williams, he co-wrote The Anthropocene, a Multidisciplinary Approach. A member of the Anthropocene Working Group of the International Commission on Stratigraphy, he's a co-editor of its recent summary, The Anthropocene as a Geological Time Unit, a Guide to the Scientific Evidence and Current Debate. Jan and Mark, welcome to COVID Calls.
Hello, Scott.
Hello, Scott. Very nice to be here.
Well, it's great to be back on COVID Calls, and to have you both as first guests I've had in 6 months is really a thrill. And we're going to talk in depth about your book. And congratulations about getting The Cosmic Oasis out, pandemic notwithstanding. Let me start the way I usually do, just to find out where you're calling from. Maybe give us a sense of the COVID situation there now. Jan, let me start with you on that.
I'm speaking from Keyworth near Nottingham in the English Midlands, relatively quiet part of the Midlands, and where, if you looked at it now, it's also quiet with respect to COVID, the pandemic is still with us, but it would be hard to guess from walking around the village or going to the shop very few people wearing masks, observing distancing or anything like that. So it looks like the community here is coming to terms, in its own way, with the virus.
Jan, as you look back over this time of the pandemic, is there a memory that strikes you now as particularly clear and strong?
Well, there are quite a few, the pandemic has, has affected both Mark and me, quite strongly in different ways. The memory, is one of the positive ones to cherish from that, from the last couple of visits of my son and his partner, who live away. They live in Birmingham, and because they're aware that there's an immunocompromised state in the family, they went to the trouble of isolating each time for 2 weeks, before coming to see us, and that was nice. That was great. That was it made their company all the better.
Well, thanks for sharing that. It's something that isolation time is something that people, again, as we move along in this, maybe they forget how much isolation time they have received as a gift from others, or they have undertaken on their own. I met somebody not long ago who is a professor in Korea, but is from China and also has family in the United States. And he told me he had quarantined at least 6 weeks. And this was 6 months ago. So he may have done more quarantine time since then, but those increments of time really, really add up, don't they?
Yes, they do, and it's the I think the effect, on us all, are as you said, they're subtle, they're incremental, but they do alter the way, that we see, we interact with the world, we think about the world, that is, I think that will be a future topic of study, in years to come, once hopefully, there is some sort of normalization after all this.
Absolutely. Mark, let me bring you in. Same question, how you're seeing things in the UK. What kind of clues are there that, COVID is still out and about? And then if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about your own personal experience, I'd love to hear it.
So I'm calling in from my office in Leicester University, and you can kind of see the mire of rocks and files and things behind me, which is typical of a geologist's office. I think Jan's looks even more messy than mine, I think. I can certainly talk about COVID from a personal perspective. I mean, certainly in the summer, COVID was still surging in the UK. Seems to have gone down a little bit now. I personally caught COVID in the summer, and the whole family did, and we were laid low with it for about a week, I think. And recently, it was kind of implicated in the death of my father. So I've got a very personal and close kind of emotional connection with what's happened over the last couple of years, which is something, of course, which is shared by many people around the world. As you know, I mean, that very beautiful biography you gave of Mark Lewiton at the start really touched me, actually, Scott. I mean, I have to say, your humanity comes through so clearly, and it's really wonderful to see that. So obviously that was poignant for me too. So yeah, it's fairly raw with me at the moment. In terms of thinking about positives from COVID, though, I think one of the things that I really recall is at the very, very start of COVID, when we went into the really severe lockdown, and we couldn't really move outside of our, you know, local environment. Only, you know, we couldn't really go more than a mile away from home. I walked in the local area and I found several landscapes and several woodlands that I didn't even know existed, because, you know, I'd been so used to getting in my car and driving to work. And I found some wonderful landscapes where I was able, in the midst of COVID, to reconnect much more clearly with nature. There's a woodland very close, you know, about half a mile down the road from me that we discovered. And we walked there as a family and, you know, listening to the birds and watching the squirrels and you know, seeing the butterflies was really good for the soul during that period. So it's a positive for me is the reconnection with nature that I think many people found during that isolation of COVID.
First of all, I'm just acknowledge sharing the news about your family and your father. And I'm sorry to hear that. And I hope your family has found some peace. I know so many families have had a disruption also of mourning because of COVID, but I hope you've been able to be with family.
Yes, the kind of severe restrictions on people meeting up are not there anymore. So I was able to be with my dad as he passed away. And so, yeah, you know, obviously many people were not able to do that. And yeah, I can really understand and appreciate the pain that must have caused people, having just gone through this myself a few weeks ago. So fortunately, from that perspective, Scott, I was able to be with my dad. But I know many people obviously weren't.
Let me take a moment just to remind everyone that you're listening to COVID Calls. And my guests today are Mark Williams and Jan Zelishevich. And we're talking about their book, The Cosmic Oasis, which is out this year. I'm going to talk about the biosphere. And part of that biosphere, of course, is the viral biosphere, which we'll get to in our conversation. Mark, I was struck by your description of discovering new woodlands, new areas of nature that were quite close by. And you're by no means the first guest I've had on COVID Calls who's described that quite interesting experience. I have to say, though, I'm a little surprised at you, Mark. I wouldn't think there'd be 100 miles from your house that you hadn't dug a spade into at some point, particularly based on what I read in this book. How did you discover some new nature so close to home?
I think it's because I live on an area, it's a beautiful landscape, it's a Jurassic landscape, so you get lots of rolling hills between the mudstones that form the valleys and the limestones that form the hills. But I'm not an expert on Jurassic rocks, so I didn't go out looking for Jurassic fossils. If I'd been on the Cambrian or on the Carboniferous, I would have been squirreling away trying to find fossils on a daily basis, I think. So that's my own bias, my own geological bias.
So I want to just introduce the audience to this book a little bit. It's really a tremendous achievement of a book. And you can be a historian of science like myself and trained and find a lot in here that will enhance your knowledge. Or you can be a person who just enjoys reading science page in the newspaper and still find a lot to learn in here. You're quite good at reaching multiple audiences. I just want to set this up a little bit. You write towards the beginning of the book that we are part of life, one latecomer species among millions. That's us, humans. For most of the existence of our species, we lived with little impact on our environment, you write. Then a few tens of millennia ago, Homo sapiens, first in Africa, and then spreading out across the old world, triggered a larger, uniquely human impact on nature that gathered pace over time. In the past century or so, the pace of this transformation has rocketed, and we've become a species that is now quite unlike any other in the history of this planet, capable of both profoundly understanding and profoundly altering, perhaps destroying, the web of life that surrounds us and of which we are a part. And then we're off and running, trying to understand the biosphere in many different scales. But I want to start. So that's kind of how you launch us into this examination. And I want to ask you, Jan, let me ask you first about this. Why an interest? I mean, it sounds in some ways like such a general question, but I want to know what you think of it. Why are you interested in life on Earth? But why particularly are you interested in the diversity of life on Earth?
Well, it's a great question, and a difficult one also, because it's easier to find interest in specifics, you know, whether it's Marx, Jurassic, you know, goniotites or you know, other individual phenomena like that. But trying to stretch that to look at the whole of life, that's a much harder thing to grasp. And it was, you know, I think it's a struggle that's been developing with both Mark and myself, really throughout our careers, because we started off quite specific, both Mark and I, working on particular groups of fossils, and then gradually extending out, you know, partly because, you know, we had to teach different subjects, or partly because the research kind of gravitated into mud rocks, in my case, you know, or different groups of fossils and ecosystems in Mark's. And then you try and make sense of it all. And I think that's what we try and do broadly in our work. And of course, this all is life. And I think two reasons. One, in itself, you know, there is no bigger or more fascinating subject, you know, particularly because it is so cosmically rare. You know, the Earth really is, you know, a huge rarity, you know, of all the planets we know now out there. And also because at this very time, it happens to be changing dramatically, you know, perhaps as dramatically as any time it's ever changed. You know, so, you know, the challenge is there to try and get some sort of grasp on this and work out some sort of narrative, you know, of that. You know, so in effect, it's been a kind of logical progression. But at every step on the way, we were biting off more than we could chew in that, you know, and the trick is to try and, you know, not show the gaps too much, but to try and express some of the large patterns, you know, within this enormous, you know, field, you know, the biosphere, you know, it's more than life itself.
Mark, let me bring you in on that, and particularly this problem that Jan points to about, you know, it's an issue in science of being hyper-specialized. And the profession, every profession in the academy rewards hyper-specialization, I think, and actively dissuades generalization. That's one issue. But then also the task of this book, telling the story of the biosphere, how do you choose the scale at which to do that?
I think it's a scale that you can pick only when you've been doing a subject like this for a very long period of time. Both Jan and I have got quite a lot of grey hairs in this subject. I mean, I guess between us, we must have about 80 years collective experience of looking at the deep time record. And I kind of reiterate what Jan has said. You know, we started looking at individual groups of fossils, and, you know, in very specific time frames. But we've both been lucky enough in our careers to be able to work across different time frames over the past 500 million years in particular. And so as you go on, you start to recognize and notice patterns of similarity, even in different time frames, even using different groups of organisms, that you're able to use, I think, to understand some of the kind of causal mechanisms that cause major evolutionary radiations, you know, or cause mass extinctions. And I think both of us then, Jan first and then me following, arrived at this understanding that you could use that deep time record potentially to inform what's happening at present, where we're on the precipice of a major extinction event and a fundamental reorganization of the biosphere. I mean, fundamental on a level equivalent to any of the major changes to the biosphere in deep time. But I think it's very important to, when you're looking at that, to have an appreciation of that deep time record. So it's kind of grown out of a collective experience, I guess, over 30, 40 years for each of us, that's enabled us to be able to think about the patterns in this kind of broader picture, but still having that ability, I think, to understand the specialities of the subject as well.
I mean, just to underline the difficulty of this task, so this is not just taking stock of the biosphere as it is presently living on this planet, but also the deep time record of species that are gone. I won't ask you which you like better, Mark, but help us understand a little bit of the ratio, maybe. You know, the number of species that we think no longer exist versus the ones that exist. How do we even begin to get our minds around that problem?
So I think what we see in the fossil record is extremely incomplete. I mean, there are a few million species basically kind of documented, and that's nowhere near the diversity that's recognized for the amount of species living at present. So we're probably looking at something like, you know, 5% of the record of what's ever lived actually being preserved in the fossil record, or maybe even less than that. Because most things just don't preserve. You know, if you haven't got a hard skeleton, if you haven't got a hard shell, then you've got a very, very low chance of preservation. Just occasionally you do get soft tissues preserved, but it's very rare. Now, even though we've only got a small percentage of the fossil record preserved, we can nevertheless recognize in that fossil record that there have been some very substantial patterns of change over time. So we can pick up these, you know, these big extinction events. There are five of them in the past 500 million years. The most recent one being, you know, the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary 66 million years ago, when a giant asteroid hit the Gulf of Mexico and caused a mass extinction. So even though we've only got a very small component of the fossil record preserved, we can nevertheless pick out these patterns, and they are then extremely important when we come to think about interpreting the very large changes to the biosphere that are happening at present, as a, you know, this time not caused by an asteroid impact or by massive climate change or sustained supervolcanic eruptions, but humans are now the causal mechanism.
So I just want to linger on something you said there for a second. I'm teaching a history class to undergraduates right now, and I always start every class with some talk about how historians do what they do, and you know, geologists and historians are kindred spirits, of course, and I said geologists have it easy compared to historians because they have a lot more materials to work with. There's more in the rock than there is in the written record. So you may not agree with me, but I, you know, you're even pointing to 5% existing there. I think most people would think that's a startlingly small amount of the history of the biosphere of this planet. But I mean, Jan, that's enough to work with, isn't it? I mean, you can really tell some quite intricate stories even with that amount of evidence.
Yes, for sure. I mean, and I think the business of looking at the strata and reading them pretty much like books, you know, is key to this. And again, Mark mentioned the experience, and we've both spent, you know, of those collective 80 years, then there's quite a few of those been, you know, crawling up brambly stream sections or scrambly cliffs and hitting away at the strata of the hammer, layer by layer by layer, you know, in effect, page by page by page. And on those pages, you know, there are, the remains of dead animals and plants, you know, sometimes abundantly. You can, you know, find, you know, hundreds or thousands in a day, you know, each in their different pages. And I think it's hard to overestimate the confidence that this gives you that you're dealing with something that's real, you know, because you know that you're doing this and you know colleagues who are doing this in other parts of the world, and you can compare the results and you can go to other places and so on. And so that 5%, you know, albeit it's a 5%, you know, with hard parts, you know, with skeletons, the patterns we get there, you know, are subtle and detailed and reproducible, you know, from one study to another, and they can tell us something about the, you know, the long boring times of life. We're not very much changed, you know, except gradually, and then the sudden changes. You know, of course, because we're humans, we're like drama, we dwell on the sudden changes. But it's important to realize, you know, the you know, if you like, the hundreds of meters of strata, you know, and the millions of years in which not very much happened. Life went on, you know, maybe, you know, one or two new species appeared, one or two disappeared. But I think, you know, the fact that the Earth, you know, even with meteorite strikes and volcanic outbursts, can jog along, you know, quite stably for such a long time, I think it's worth emphasizing, because we are used to living in drama. And it's often said that in the past, oh, it's all drama too. No, it's not. A lot of it is really quite dull and steady, year by year, thousand year by thousand year, even million year by million year. The events when things really happen, they also are less than 5%, you know, perhaps 1% of the time. You know, these really, you know, most of time is, you know, as I say, things go along, you know, stably.
You know, I love the metaphor of the pages and reading the stratigraphic record in that way, Jan. There's some good characters in there too. I wonder, you know, is there a particular species, plant or animal, that comes through those pages that really you have enjoyed telling the story of?
Well, I think both, you know, Mark and I have got our, you know, the fossil groups we have focused on. Because we focused on them, they've become our favorites, you know, I think. And I think it's the same for any paleontologist. The more you know, the more you like, you know. So both Mark and I have worked on creatures called graptolites, the ancient colonial zooplankton, which lived about 400 or 500 million years ago, when you can find on the bottom of petrified sea floors, you know, in abundance. And they're beautiful, they're enigmatic, there's nothing quite like them living today. You know, we could enthuse about them, you know, all day, all night, and all the next day as well, because it's really so much. Yes, there they are.
Yeah. What are we looking at, Mark? Just walk us through it, because, you know, a lot of us are just seeing a rock.
Okay, so you can see the surface of the rock, and this is one of those layers that Jan was talking about, like a page from a book. But strewn over the surface, you can perhaps see these tuning fork-like structures. Absolutely. Those tuning fork-like structures are the skeletal remains of graptolites that Jan has been talking about, and they're colonial. So if you look at them in detail, I don't know whether I can get it close enough to the camera, you probably see that the edges are serrated on the inner surface, and each serration is basically the house, the home of a little animal that lived in there. And they lived together in groups of, you know, probably 20 or 30 of them, I guess, on each one of these colonies. And they lived as plankton in the ocean. So those are graptolites, some beautiful specimens from Aberaidhe Bay in South Wales.
Mark, let me bring the same question to you. I mean, thank you for that demonstration. It was great. I enjoyed reading about velvet worms in this book. Can you tell us about that?
So velvet worms are not my specialist group, but they're a really interesting group of organisms, because they've got quite low diversity at present. There's only about 200 species documented, which is, you know, quite small if you think about other groups of organisms, which have tens of thousands of species. Birds, for example, they're quite small. You probably wouldn't notice them. They typically live in kind of damp areas in tropical rainforests, and they're essentially tropical at present. But they appear to have a fossil record that goes back to the Cambrian. Certainly some groups of fossils that we find in the Cambrian 500 million years ago look very similar to modern living velvet worms. And the interesting thing about velvet worms is they started off as aquatic organisms, so they were living in the oceans. Now they're entirely landlubbers, they live on the land. They've got almost no fossil record for the intervening 500 million years, because they're just soft-bodied. They have little tiny little bits of skeletons in their skin, but nothing that usually fossilizes very well. And yet somehow they've managed to survive over 500 million years. And even though their diversity is low at present, even though they've got relatively specific ecologies that they occupy, they've got this incredible ability to survive, you know, through five mass extinction events in over 500 million years. And the other important thing about them, about velvet worms, and they're well worth Googling to get a picture of what they look like, because they're remarkable little animals. The other remarkable thing about them I've forgotten what I was about to say there, Scott. I've gone off in a different direction. I was talking about their ability to survive over 500 million years, wasn't I? I've forgotten what I was going to say. in addition to that.
Well, that's all right. We'll come back to it. I mean, that. Go ahead, Jan.
One of the reasons that Mark, you know, had the wonderful idea to put them in the book, you know, is that it's a very small group, but they are they're a phylum in themselves. You know, they're one of the, you know, the main branches of life. You know, a rather slender one, and over, you know, this past 500 million years since we've had any kind of multicellular life, we haven't yet lost. We've lost many species, many genera, many families, but not yet a phylum. And you know, with what's happening to the rainforests now, you know, they may be the first phylum to be lost in 500 million years. You know, because we don't know the ecological tolerances, we don't have this, you know, this information from fossil record. So it was, a poster child for the rare and delicate, but important, because they represent a fundamental, you know, distinct kind of body plan.
It's an alarming insight. Mark, I think I saw you have a sort of a light bulb go off on your head. Did you have something you want to throw in?
Yeah, thanks to Jan for coming to my rescue there. That's exactly what I wanted to say. And the other bit, just the other little bit to add to that is that velvet worms seem to sit very low on the branch of evolution that leads to all of insect life, of all of arthropod life on planet Earth. So all the crustaceans, you know, crabs and lobsters and spiders and all the insects, they sit at the kind of root of all of that evolutionary tree. And if we were to lose them, we'd lose a phylum, a whole group of animals, as Jan said, but we'd also lose our evidence of how organisms that evolved into this incredible diversity of life over hundreds of millions of years. So, you know, that they're a small group. They've got very low diversity. They're ecologically restricted, but they're incredibly important in terms of preserving the history of life on planet Earth.
Let me take a second here just again to remind folks that you're listening to COVID Calls. COVID Calls is back today, September 14th, after a hiatus since March of earlier this year, and it's thrilled to have Jan Zalashevich and Mark Williams on to talk about their new book, The Cosmic Oasis. You know, in our discussion up to now, there's a sort of conditional hanging over, particularly our last discussion there of the velvet worms. There's a lot of if and this sort of alarming possibility that a species that has such a very, very long history, that much could be lost if it gets wrapped up into this era of extinction. So I want to turn to that now. I mean, you're both members of the Anthropocene Working Group. And I think listeners, viewers of COVID Calls have a general sense of the Anthropocene as a geological time in which human beings are the dominant shaping force on Earth. Let's say a little bit, let's talk a little bit more about that. And Jan, let me bring you in first on that. I guess we are on the verge of great change. We're living in the midst of great change. And you talked about these long periods of quietude in the record. It's not the case now, but how do we know that?
It's a great question. And again, I think the answer again is to put this change into perspective. A useful perspective here, I think, and one that I think surprised both Mark and me at how clearly it stood out, was the, a perspective more familiar to historians and archaeologists, you know, the last 10,000 years of what we call the Holocene, the epoch we're still formally living in, which was a little more than 10,000 years of climate stability, of sea level stability, you know, after the ice reached its present level about 7,000 years ago, and one of continual human influence, you know, of farming, of hunting, of settling, of empires growing and falling, all the kind of things that you study. So humans have their paw prints all over, you know, the Holocene in that, and yet there was this basic stability of, if you like, the basic planetary life control functions, the carbon cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the phosphorus cycle, the overall integrity of the biosphere, you know, on land and especially in the oceans where it was largely untouched in there. So it was a kind of, if you like, a magical coexistence, you know, the human world and you know, a stable planetary world. And I think the surprise both for Mark and me once we began to look at this more closely was just how quickly and how steeply and how recently, you know, these major planetary changes to atmospheric carbon dioxide and methane, and therefore to climate, to the nitrogen cycle, the phosphorus cycle, the rate at which species extinctions and species invasions have suddenly, you know, zoomed upwards in the last century, you know, is you know, it really is a dramatic change. It's the change from essentially a horizontal line to a vertical and climbing line, you know, with, you know, about a couple of centuries, you know, at the bend between them, you know, so we have to work out exactly where we put the boundary. But the important thing is the horizontal line of 10,000 years plus, and then the vertical line, you know, of a time when the, it's not that humans have begun, it's the time when the planet has begun to respond in a very large way to human impacts, you know, which have, you know, it's I feel like it's crossed the threshold, and the planet, you know, is now taking off in a new direction, biosphere included, of course, which is in that, you know, so that is, you know, if you like, the, you know, to understand the Anthropocene, you know, we have to have a good understanding, you know, of, you know, the millennia before, and then to understand that it's the many millennia and millions of years before that.
So that's part of what you're tracking in the book. I mean, you're telling the story of humans, but not only. I mean, humans in relation to, and as Jan is saying, Ark, in a deep historical sense, so that we can have a baseline to then understand the magnitude of the changes that are happening right now. I think people are generally pretty pretty confident, you know, with their understanding that, you know, carbon in the atmosphere has some, CO2 in the atmosphere has something to do with that. But there's many, many, many other measures that you talk about in the book, Mark. Take us into the world of Anthropocene metrics, if you will.
So I could do that very much from a biosphere perspective, I think, because the figures are really dramatic. I mean, as Jan has said, you have to understand the whole of human history, really, to contextualize this. And you know, humans as a species have certainly had an impact on the biosphere, certainly for 50,000 years, possibly a bit longer than that, you know, and in the way in which we've, you know, hunted animals, reconfigured ecosystems, translocated species. I mean, we've been moving species around the planet probably for 20,000 years. But those processes have accelerated very, very rapidly over the past couple of centuries and ongoing very much into the 20th century. So just to try and quantify that from a biosphere perspective and just to show how fundamental the change is, and really fundamental relative to any other measure that Jan and I might look at in the geological record. You know, I think some of the figures that are striking are like, you know, the 96% of terrestrial mammal biomass, which is humans and our commensal animals, the animals that we eat. I mean, 96% concentrated into that group of organisms is I think remarkable in the entire you know, history of the Earth. The way in which we have monopolized the land, so we've converted 50% of the habitable surface to farming. You know, and about 75% of that is actually used for animals and for dairy, so for meat and dairy. And even the other 25% that's used for agriculture, a lot of that's used to support that meat and dairy. Again, that's a phenomenal figure for a single species to dominate so much of the landscape in the ecosystem. And of course, uniquely for any species in Earth history, we also dominate the oceans too. We have been fishing the oceans at excessive rates, taking tens of millions of tons of fish products out of the oceans each year, and as a result, reconfiguring those ecosystems, and even threatening organisms like sharks that have been evolving on this planet for hundreds of millions of years. I mean, they're really being perturbed now by the actions of humans. Those are some figures. We can talk about translocations of species. There are literally tens of thousands of species now that have been moved around the planet by humans. That's been measured by, particularly by a group led by Hannah Siebens in the Senckenberg in Frankfurt, have quantified the number of species that have been translocated. And it's accelerating as you go into the later part of the 20th century. And of course, a part of that also, a part of this reconfiguring of the ecosystems and its accelerating impact is that we're also then precipitating extinctions, very profound extinctions in island ecosystems, but now also those are translocating onto the land also, or onto the mainland, if you like, onto the continents and into the oceans, and leaving a clear fossil signal that Jan and I can detect in the geological record. So we can now go out into a place like San Francisco Bay or the River Thames in London, and we can see clear evidence in the shells that are preserved in the sediments of a wholesale reconfiguration of ecosystems on this planet, which is leaving a geological record.
Mark, let me stay with you on this, and Jan, I want to get you in on this as well. I want to bring it back to COVID, because I'm wondering if you could, based on everything you're just saying there and this remarkable set of indicators that humans are reshaping the biosphere and then reshaping it again faster at faster rates, which itself is also alarming. But now we have a new virus. I mean, talking again about the biosphere, we have this this new virus which emerges in late 2019, somehow related to the anthropocenic processes that you're describing, and propagated because of the technospheric aspect of this Anthropocene period. We'll talk more about the technosphere in a minute. But can I just get your sort of headline level take on this, Mark? I mean, the relationship between the biosphere as it's changing now and SARS-CoV-2?
Yeah, I mean, COVID-19 is a direct symptom of what we're seeing of this interconnectedness of human societies through our transport networks it's been utilized by COVID-19. But many other species have done this also. I mean, we've recognized the impact of COVID-19 because it directly impinges on us and it's directly damaged, human societies and human ecosystems. But there are many, many species out there which have been translocated through the same kind of means. Golden apple snails, for example, from South America into Southeast Asia, and in their indigenous environment, they're harmless. You know, they're part of the broader ecosystem. But when they get into a new ecosystem, they can do considerable damage to that ecosystem. Golden apple snails are just one example. And in that sense, I think COVID-19 is exactly the same. It's just that we've noticed it because it's now directly affecting us and our ecologies. But these problems, these broader problems with ecosystems and ecologies are manifest, and they're manifest for many species and ecosystems on this planet. And it's a wake-up call, really, for us to understand that this will get worse unless we start to do something very, 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 very considerable about it.
Jan, let me get you in on this, and kind of a basic question. I mean, if I understand, going back to my high school biology, a virus isn't alive, but it's certainly part of the biosphere. Right.
Yes, they're crystals with agency, if you like, organic crystals, but they do evolve. They follow the basic Darwinian patterns of evolution very rapidly, as we've seen. And Mark's quite right. It is a symptom, of these biological biospheric changes that we've seen. And again, taking the long, long view, it's worth emphasizing that while we're heading towards the sixth great mass extinction in the last half billion years, and that hasn't happened yet. With great deal of luck and a following wind, it won't quite happen, at least to that, marvelous scale. Fingers crossed, we hope. But what has happened, is a homogenization of the biosphere, a blurring of all the biogeographic boundaries that have been in place for that half billion years, and that only here and there have changed as one continent, let's say, has merged with another, or, an ocean barrier has come up. So this homogenization is, which we now, of course, is taking place continually between every ocean and every continent, to have this kind of mixing going on, that really is a novelty in the whole of the planet's history.
Is the issue with that it's happening itself, or is it the speed that with which it's happening? What's the alarming part of that change?
I think both. It's global nature. You know, that it really does involve the whole planet, and it's very, very quick. The example we use in the book, or one example we use, is when the Americas joined, North and South linked up, you know, and the Panama Isthmus formed, you know, some 3 million years ago now. Again, there was an interchange between those two continents, but it took time. You know, first you had the very strong swimmers making it across, you know, and the ones that could then leapfrog islands and so on. So that change, you know, did take, you know, many thousands, if not, you know, 1 or 2 million years. And here we're doing something, you know, within, you know, centuries, and at this scale, within decades.
There's an argument that I hear made sometimes, and it's a pretty popular argument in cultures that are technologically enthusiastic. That would include the UK, the United States, South Korea, much of the world, if not all of the world now. And if you teach at an engineering school like I do, you might hear a discussion that goes something like this. Yes, there are problems out there. No, we won't deny the Anthropocene as a reality. But human beings are incredibly tough, resilient, and innovative. And so we will engineer our way out of this Anthropocene and have a nice soft landing. In fact, there might even be some money to be made here. Mark, I'm characterizing it in a little bit of a cartoonish way, but I think you've probably heard that argument, haven't you?
Yes, and I think, you know, technology may have a role to play here in helping us, but it's not the panacea answer that it's sometimes presented at. And I think we could use the example of avocados and the fact that we all want avocados in the middle of winter in Europe or in other parts of the world. And that means that you have to have, you know, intensive avocado production in South America, for example, and that has to be exported to other parts of the world. But in order to pollinate the plants in the first place, you might need to import bees that were perhaps not native to South America. And those bees, once they find their way into the native environment, can have a dramatic effect on the indigenous bees. Now, that's an example of where a technological fix, in effect, has gone extremely wrong. But it's also an example of where if we as humans changed our behavior, and for example, said, well, we don't want avocados in the middle of winter. We'll manage with them when they're, you know, when they're seasonally available, for example, in their natural cycle. Or we'll find alternatives, local alternatives to use that. I think we could have a big impact on making the world a better place. So it's not simply that we can use technology to fix all the problems that we have. We have to have fundamental behavioral change, I think, all of us individually, if we want to preserve a space for the rest of the biosphere to thrive in.
Just to build on that, I'm leading up to asking you both about some maybe practical policy-oriented reactions to these changes that we're seeing in the cosmic oasis, as you term it. But I want to, you know, Jan, I want to pick up where what Mark was just saying. There's some shoulds and some oughts and some norms here that are being discussed. But I want to push you a little bit on the basis of that. Is this about species survival? Is this about humans surviving? Or is this concern go beyond that? And I guess what I'm really getting at is a sort of a multi-species. What's your basis for thinking about the care of other species on this planet? Do we have an ethic, a legal system, other spiritual things we can lean on? What are we grounded in to help us think about care for species that go beyond us?
Oh, these are very deep waters, I think, you know, for us, because we grow up, you know, within, you know, certain sets of value systems. And I think we've all grown up in a set of value systems, you know, in which life, liberty and all of these things, you know, are paramount and defended. And of course, it's human life that's you know, largely, you know, been the focus of that and of, if you like, lawmaking and regulation, you know, and cultural, you know, patterns and responses and behaviors over that time. And certainly, I remember from my childhood, it was kind of assumed, in serious conversation and things like the science fiction you read, that part of this was the technology would make things better and better and better in that. And so it's been something of a shock, I think, to many, to me that the spin-offs from the technology could have consequences so severe as to threaten the whole enterprise, both human and beyond human, in that the whole fabric of the biosphere of which we are part and of which we depend. So we're now at the stage of trying to come to terms with this in some way and establish some patterns and norms and ways of thinking and ways of behaving that will fit the Anthropocene, a time of instability, rather than the Holocene, which is generally a time of great stability, at least in a planetary supportive sense, even if political systems and so on kept changing all the time, mm-hmm. as they did. But you had this, we now have this new element of uncertainty, added in. I think neither Mark and I have got any great policy wisdom here. We have colleagues who work, on this. Paleontologists, I don't think, have got any greater insights, and probably rather fewer insights than the average on this. But it is a new situation, and the human part, of course, is one thing to think of. The technological part is another. And I think, again, you referred, and we referred here, to the fact that we're living, within, as well as a biosphere, which is more than the sum of all living things, we're living within a technosphere, which is more than the sum of all the machines that we have. And it has dynamics of itself. And according to some of our colleagues, its needs are not the same as our needs. And yet it's keeping us alive in a very large numbers on the planet. And somehow, we're all trying to think of ways, of keeping the show on the road. And in terms of the practicalities of that, then, I think, say, Marx and my colleagues, often have much deeper and better things to say than, we can, brought up on graptolites and such.
But that dynamic that you're pointing to, Jan, is a powerful one. So the being able to tell a difference between a biosphere and a technosphere, or a world of technology in which we are embedded and even on our bodies and in our bodies. I think even this time we've lived through, that the enthusiasm, and I count myself among the enthusiasts, for new vaccines, that enthusiasm is about human optimism. It's about human ingenuity. It's also about capitalism. I mean, it's about a lot of things which are also implicated in this period of uncertainty that you're describing. So Mark, I guess I'm describing a sort of a circularity in which I feel like we find ourselves sometimes. I mean, additional data point, the animal reservoirs in which COVID is also gone into now. In North America, apparently the deer population is a massive reservoir for COVID. So we have many species depending and interacting with one another in the biosphere, and technologies which seem to make us aware of everything that's happening and showing us a way out. And yet all of this massive change is hanging over it. I think I've tried to just summarize your book. I haven't done a good job, but there's that sense of it to me at the end, as we come to the end of the book, that we have to really pay very close attention to the interconnection among these different parts, because the time for some action is now.
I think Jan's talked about the technosphere, and it's an ever-present component at the surface of our planet. It is a sphere, like the other spheres, the lithosphere and the biosphere, the hydrosphere and the atmosphere. but it is fundamentally different from those other spheres. I mean, I've heard Jan say several times that the biosphere is much more than just life, and that's absolutely right, of course, because in its very definition, the biosphere is all life and its interactions with those other Earth system components, with the hydrosphere and the atmosphere and the geosphere, lithosphere. The difference with the technosphere is that it's this emergent sphere, and it hasn't co-evolved with those other components over billions of years. So the other components have evolved together, and together they've evolved to make this habitable space for life on planet Earth in a way which is mutually beneficial, that they operate together for the mutual benefit, if you like, or for the benefit of life. The technosphere needs to be trained by humans, if we can do it, to try and operate in a much more beneficial manner with the rest of the Earth system. How we do that is a very, very complex problem, but it's essential that we try to do that. Otherwise, it may well degrade all of the other systems that preserve us and the rest of life on this planet.
Just a quick reminder that you're listening to COVID Calls. I'm talking to Mark Williams and Jan Zalashevich today about The Cosmic Oasis, their new book, The Remarkable Story of Earth's Biosphere. And we've been tying that back in also to trying to understand this period that we've been living through in the pandemic. And I want to come back to the power of stories for a second, because it is an intensely readable book in the sense that you can kind of pick up in various different parts and find yourself in a story, an individual scientist or an individual species. You tell those stories with equal facility, which I like very much. But I think also of this time with COVID, in which, because of lockdown, because of obituary, because of the many ways our lives have changed, we have relied on stories, I think, to reconnect ourselves, to make sense of things that are scary. So, Mark, I mean, I guess it's a question about persuading people or keeping people's attention while you try to explain something that's very complicated. What role do you see for story in that task?
I think it's essential, as it always has been, actually, for relating information through human experience. I mean, you know, Jan and I might be looking at the nuts and bolts of how the biosphere works, you know, and perhaps most people wouldn't be so interested in that. And yet that biosphere is actually there sustaining all of us. And therefore, it's very important, I think, that we try to explain how it functions in a manner that we can all relate to. And so we try to use lots of metaphors, I think in the book to show that. I mean, perhaps the one that springs to mind with me is thinking about, you know, the way we've changed our patterns of consumption in the 20th century and how that's resulted in humans and the animals that we eat becoming 96% of the terrestrial mammal mass. And we talked about in the book about burger restaurants and how they've proliferated across the planet. And indeed, one of our colleagues, Will Steffen, has actually tracked that in his great acceleration graphs to show how some of those burger restaurants have expanded. You know, and that's commensurate with the doubling in human population since the 1960s, and also the doubling in meat consumption over that period of time too. And we thought it was important, for example, to work out, you know, the spatial area that those burger restaurants covered on the planet. And I think between us, we calculated that it was about half the surface area of Manhattan Island, or a chain extending from New York, an unbroken chain extending from New York to Chicago. And I think those visual images are really important because they show us how we have so massively changed the system for our own benefit, and how that isn't sustainable in the long term unless we start to change our patterns of consumption and behavior.
I think those kinds of examples are incredibly important. And also, you know, the talking about chicken, as you do in the book, or beef, you know, it's one thing to give a sort of percentage of different kinds of species that are being impacted, but talk about ones that we're quite familiar with and realize that consumption of just a few animals is having such a profound effect at scale is something that I think most people, again, they might be thinking about carbon, but they might not be thinking about a burger restaurant. There's something else I wanted to get to. We're up on time in a few minutes, but Jan, let me ask you about this first, because, you know, I think many people are familiar with the work of historian Naomi Oreskes, for example, who's written about the problem of what she calls merchants of doubt, Eric Conway and Naomi Oreskes, and many other, you know, social scientists in many cases, who are trying to document the ways that information is being corrupted. And so I wanted to get into this with you first, because you were talking about that record, those pages. And of course, there was a lot of debate in the 19th century whether or not some of those pages were forged. Just to extend the metaphor a little bit, that maybe the rock record doesn't tell us the truth that the geologists say it does. I don't think we're living in the first age of disinformation or concern about it, is what I'm saying. But it does seem to be extremely hazardous right now. I mean, through COVID, through climate change, and more broadly about the Anthropocene, the many different indicators that you're talking about. Give me your sense of the scale of that problem, the misinformation, disinformation, conspiracy thinking.
Yeah, it's quite clearly something that is developing. I mean, misinformation has always been with us, and propaganda, you know, from, as you know, you work as a historian, you know, it's people have their own axes to grind, if you like, you know, on issues that affect them, you know, their families, their communities, you know, their nation states or whatever. That's always been with us. And the last, I guess, decade, two, three, has seen the growth of a new version of that, which is, technologically zoomed up version, you know, using, you know, all the facilities of the internet of that. And it is problematic because it's we're human animals, we're affected by all the stimuli we get from different places. And it's very hard to know which stimulus is a real one, which reflects reality, and which is not. On that, I suspect this is something that we're going to be dealing with, you know, for the foreseeable future. Mark and I are lucky in that sense, and our colleagues in that we've had the time, as we've said before, you know, mm-hmm. of communing with the rocks, you know, and we have a colleague who says you can't argue with a rock. That is a
rocks,
reality.
Yeah. Rocks don't tweet.
Rocks don't tweet, luckily. on that, they have their own story, which is independent, and it does make us realize that there is a reality out there. You know, we can't always perceive all of it. We have to think it through, and the rocks sometimes do speak, you know, with a forked tongue or a sense of humor. You've got to be alive to all of that kind of thing. You know, and that's something that extends to the whole of the observable world of science, of COVID statistics or anything else in that. I think the trick is to try and expose, you know, if you like, to make sure that of the emerging generation, as many, you know, of the youngsters and young people coming up have the experience of within their own sphere of learning there is such a thing as reality, and therefore using that experience, you know, to then understand the rest of the world, and especially the rest of the vast amount of information coming at them. Naomi, does that superbly, you know, in her work. And so she takes us as a focus. But I think, we who've had the, you know, whether you're working on James Webb telescope information, on ecological information from the rainforest, you know, or the deep ocean floor, or on the information from rocks, there is a reality out there, you know, so the trick is to trying to convey that in a way which preserves its rigor, its reality, doesn't oversimplify, and yet can make, you know, give it, if you like, the importance it deserves in trying to deal with all the changes around us.
So
I'm sorry, I'm rambling on, but it's a tricky thing.
No, and I really there's a part of what you're describing, I think, also has to do with science and audience, and the way that maybe the audience is sort of a catch-22 problem. I think the audience for scientific information has grown quite remarkably, and social media has had a big role to play in that. I mentioned this earlier before we started our conversation, that people's desire to understand statistics, which has a carryover effect to the way they'll understand phenomena like the biosphere and climate change, hugely important outcome of the early days of the pandemic, but is that same medium which allows this very rapid dissemination of mistruths in some cases, or wrong facts, wrong information, or in some cases, very malicious information. And so I guess it's that bind we've been talking about a little bit, you know, that humans seem to like the drama, you said earlier, Jan. We like change. Our markets like change. We like innovation. But the pace is killing us, and not only us. We're just up on time. I want to ask you, at any scale, planetary, national, in your own backyard, what's a change, an action somebody listening to this call can take to contribute meaningfully to the continuation of the biosphere, or even to make the biosphere healthier than it has been over these last 50 to 100 years?
I think one tangible thing you can do is if you have some land associated with your property, is to just allow some of it to grow wild, and also to develop a garden which is consistent with the native biome where you live. You know, instead of planting things that won't reproduce or won't necessarily benefit local insect life or you know, invertebrates or small mammals, plant things that will, and you see rapid changes to your garden. It's one of the things I did in lockdown, actually, was to rewild my garden, and I'm just amazed at the range of mushrooms I get now that I never saw before, because they're wow. clearly forming a symbiosis with some of those native plants, and the insects come back, you know, the birds come in because you've got the insects in your garden. I know Jan's garden is the same. He's got a lovely wild garden at the back, and I kind of copied that, but the change is amazing, and the enjoyment you can get from that of seeing the wildlife flourish in your garden is just amazing.
Jan, same question to you. Mark is rewilding. What are you doing?
Mark's the same. Yes, I think if you just let things go, you know, then that's certainly as Mark said, it's remarkable, you know, how much change you can see and enjoy. I think if you it's no sense doing things out of grim duty. You know, this is something that really can, you know, help us in all kinds of way. The simple things, you know, think about energy. You know, when you're passing the supermarket shelves, be aware more of the context of you know, the lives of those poor chickens, you know, spread out on the thing there and on the shelves, and so on. I've often thought, you know, it would be a good thing to try and work out, a kind of list of pleasures of the Anthropocene, you know, things that you can do, you can greatly enjoy, like reading those books and journals, which take you into other worlds without being quite as destructive, you know, or quite as much taking for granted, life's possibilities, you know, as we may have used to, in our youth. There was a sense the world was endless. Mm-hmm. Now it's very true. There are limitations there. We have to keep to, but within those limitations, you know, try and make our lives as rich as possible.
So the book is The Cosmic Oasis, the remarkable story of Earth's biosphere. And I've been talking today on COVID calls with Jan Zelishevich and Mark Williams, who are co-authors of this book and also colleagues who work in the Anthropocene Working Group. Tremendous conversation. I learned a lot from the book. Really enjoyed the opportunity to speak with you both. And thanks for making time today.
Thank you, Scott. Also.
Thank you, Scott.
Stay healthy, everyone, and we'll see you next time on COVID Calls. And as I said at the open of the conversation today, we'll be doing new COVID Calls episodes for the rest of the year. So please do send your conversational ideas in, and we'll be looking forward to those. Stay healthy, everybody. We'll see you next time.